This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. There is a long history of denying the vote to African Americans, and there have been ongoing efforts to fight back against the various methods used to limit black franchise. 50 years ago, Dr. Martin Luther King shined the spotlight on a small town in Alabama.
It's time for us to say to these men that if you don't do something about it, we will have no alternative but to engage in broader and more drastic forms of civil disobedience in order to bring the attention of the nation to this whole issue in Selma, Alabama.
And on March 7th, 1965, state troopers advanced on voting rights protesters in Selma, a day known now as Bloody Sunday. 2 days later, on this day in 1965, Reverend Clark Olson, a white minister, was in Selma, Alabama, to make a show of his solidarity with the protesters. And that night, he witnessed the brutal beating of his friend, Reverend James Reeb, at the hands of four segregationists. Reeb, who was also white, died 2 days later. His death and the marches in Selma helped to push the Voting Rights Act through Congress, and President Lyndon Johnson signed it later that year. Reverend Olson made it his mission after 1965 to keep the memories of his friend and other activists alive. Reverend Clark Olson now lives in Asheville. He's a public speaker, civil rights activist, and Unitarian minister, and he joins me from WCQS in Asheville. Clark Olson, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you, Frank.
Before we take you back to Selma that night, I want to know how you became interested in the civil rights movement and where you were when you first began to think about that.
I was living in Berkeley, California at the time of Selma, but it was not the first time I'd thought of civil rights issues. I grew up with a father who was a Unitarian minister, and there were occasions in Ohio when we lived there that civil rights came up, whether it was McCarthyism or whether it was the condition of African-American employment or whatever. So I grew up with some of that sort of around the dining room table, as it were. And then when I first went into the ministry in Massachusetts, there was no particular issue at that time, but my attention was there as well as to other social issues. And when living in Berkeley in the 60s, it was difficult to avoid social issues because Berkeley was a hotbed of a variety of causes, including the Vietnam War and the student right to have political protests and political activity on the campus, as well as racial issues in the town of Berkeley, in the city of Berkeley, and the San Francisco area. So it was a place that was fraught with activity about social issues. It was part of living there.
What led you to the ministry?
Well, my father was a minister, and that was a thought that I had as I was going through college. I went to Oberlin College near Toledo, which was where we were living at that time. And I didn't know for sure that I wanted to be a minister, simply because my father had been, and that would be all I would ever know if I went into the ministry. So I had some doubts about it. I thought about law school, thought about foreign service and other things. And finally, in my senior year, it was not till my senior year that I was told by a faculty member that there was a new program from the Rockefeller Brothers Theological Fellowship Fund, and that was to encourage students to go to theological school, but one of the requirements was that you be uncertain you wanted to go into the ministry. Mm. Well, I was eminently qualified. So I received a fellowship and chose to go to Harvard Divinity School. Having been born in Boston, that seemed natural for me. And I spent 4 years going through Harvard instead of 3 years, because at the end of two, I still was uncertain. So I decided the only way I could go, I could really make up my mind, was to go be a minister in a small church at the same time I was studying at Harvard. So I took my last year, spread it over 2 years.
It seems
and
to me.
Finally decided that was what I wanted to do.
It seems to me, though, that the decision to go to Selma at that time, when so much was at stake and sort of in the press, we knew what was going on down there, that had to be a very deliberate decision, the idea of going south to be part of that march. What led you to do it?
It was, yes, it was a deliberate decision, but arrived at somewhat slowly over a few hours. I had been among, of course, the millions of Americans who saw the news broadcasts of what happened on Bloody Sunday, the grotesque violence and infamous activities of Sheriff Clark's deputies and the state troopers in beating up the black marchers across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. The brutality of that, the horses, the clubs, the tear gas, and so on, the whips that were being used. I'd seen that on television that night, Sunday night, and I abhorred that. I was shocked by it. And it was on my mind. And the next noon, on Monday noon, I happened to hear on the noon radio news broadcasts in the Berkeley area, that Martin Luther King had asked for clergy to come from across the country the next day, Tuesday. And my immediate reaction, driving the car, hearing the news, was, gee, I would really like to go. I would like to go to that. But I thought to myself, I really don't have the money to go. And I had a couple of church meetings scheduled, so I'd rather put it out of my mind until I arrived home later that afternoon, and there was a message from somebody in the congregation, very good friends, who offered to me the airfare to go to Selma if I wanted to go. Well, that suddenly took away my main excuse in my head, and it just took a few minutes for me to say, I guess I will go. I said to my wife and my then 4-year-old daughter, I felt that it was going to be safe. They were Sheriff Clark's deputies and the state troopers were not going to attack some hundreds, thousand or so clergy who were going to be there, priests, rabbis, nuns, so on. I was feeling quite sure that we were not going to get attacked. I didn't take account of the possibility of some random act of violence by somebody in the town as we were walking on the sidewalks. But anyway, I just simply decided to go.
Today on The State of Things, a conversation with Reverend Clark Olson. You did decide to go. Tell us about your friend, Reverend James Reeb.
Well, when I arrived in Selma, which was late in the day. It was after the march was ended, as a matter of fact. My plane had trouble, a mechanical problem, getting from New Orleans to Montgomery and thence to Selma. I arrived in town, and the ministers were all gathered around the front of the Brown AME Chapel with Martin Luther King speaking to them. And King said to the crowd, go off to dinner and come on back here at 7:30 and we'll talk what the next steps are. There were a lot of ministers who were disappointed in the whole in that day because it became known as Turnaround Tuesday. That is, they went out to the end of the bridge to the sheriff's deputies there and stopped and knelt and prayed and then turned around and came back to the puzzlement of some of the marchers, many of whom assumed they would just go to Selma for the day and then go back home. When King said, go have dinner and come on back and we'll talk about what's going on, what we're going to do from here, I looked around, and among the hundreds of ministers, clergy there, I saw Jim Reeb and I saw Orloff Miller, both of whom I knew before. I knew Orloff better. I was acquainted with Jim Reeb, but he and I probably had never had any substantial conversation together before that evening. It was just a happenstance of among quite a few Unitarian Universalist ministers, among others. I happened to connect with them for supper, to go to supper that night.
We'll find out what happened next when I continue my conversation with Reverend Clark Olson, a Unitarian minister who was in Selma, Alabama 50 years ago today. Just ahead, we'll hear about that trip and how it ended when we continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, Reverend Clark Olson, civil rights activist and Unitarian minister, was in Selma, Alabama 50 years ago today. He now lives in Asheville. And before the break, Reverend Olson, we were talking about your time in Selma when you had arrived there and your meeting with the Reverend Jim Reeb. So tell us what happened after Dr. King said, go have dinner and come back and talk about it.
Well, Orloff Miller, the other person whom I had dinner with, and Jim Reeb, the three of us walked over to something called the Walker's Cafe. Jim and Orloff had arrived earlier in the day. As I mentioned, I was delayed getting there because of airplane mechanical problems, so I didn't get there for the march. But they got there earlier in the day for orientation and to get a feel for the lay of the town, where were the restaurants, where were the offices, and so on. So I simply followed them, and they walked past the Boynton Insurance Agency, and the Boyntons were local blacks who were not clergy, but had a business and were very, very active in organizing the Selma voting drive. We walked past their agency and then around the block to the Walker's Cafe, which was a typically segregated black restaurant. Whites from the town didn't eat there. But that evening, it was filled with people from the march who had come from out of town. So there were both blacks and whites there in the crowded restaurant and busy and active and noisy and so on. It was a very nice feeling there of both the feeling of pride that we had all come to town and also puzzlement as to what was going to happen next.
Right.
Orloff and I had dinner together, but then we decided it was time to leave the restaurant and go back to the Brown AME Chapel. Orloff and Jim both called to their wives from the one payphone in the restaurant to tell them that they had decided to stay overnight. The three of us started walking down the street toward the Brown Chapel, and it was not following the same route we had used to get there. And about halfway down the block, suddenly we heard and saw three, four men coming at us from across the street, and they were shouting at us. They were using the N-word and saying, "Hey, you," and in a very hostile way, and frankly, got a little bit scared. We saw that one man was carrying a club or a bat or something. I don't know exactly what it was. But at that point, Orloff, Jim, and I just whispered to each other, "Just keep walking, just keep walking." And as we did, I was on the side of the sidewalk next to the building, and Jim was on the curbside, Orloff between us. As they came up behind us, by the time they reached us, we had walked on and they were coming up from behind. As they came up behind us, I, not having gotten those instructions on what to do, looked and saw the club swung at Jim Reeb's head. And I'll never forget the sound of it so much. I didn't pay attention so much to the face of the person, but I did pay attention to the club itself being swung. And to hear that hit Jim on his skull, just above his left ear, was a memorable moment for me. Orloff fell to the ground in the prescribed prayer for protection position, putting his hands and arms above his head, trying to cover his head from any blows that might come from a club or from kicking or whatever. And I, not having gotten those instructions about falling to the ground, simply ran to the corner. And one of the men ran after me and slugged me in my head and knocked my glasses off. But he disappeared in about 30 seconds or so. I was not badly hurt. I turned around and went back to where Orloff and Jim were. Jim had fallen to the ground immediately with the club that was swung at his head. He didn't anticipate it and didn't realize, not looking behind, he didn't realize that the club was just being swung at his head. I was the one who looked and saw the club. Orloff again fell to the ground. So there we were. Orloff was able to get up. I went to him, and he was not hurt that badly, although he was hurt some. I was not hurt that much. But Jim was lying there, babbling, incoherent, and we had no idea whether the attackers were going to come back and attack us again. I don't remember seeing anybody else on the sidewalk around. The attackers, we just didn't know what was going to happen. So Orloff and I managed to get Jim we had no idea of the injuries that he had. There was no blood showing. He simply was babbling and incoherent, and obviously had been hit badly, but we didn't know how badly. We got him to his feet and put his arms around our shoulders, and we walked him around the corner, around the block to the back to that insurance agency, where we knew we could get help. By the time we got there, Jim was in terrific pain. He was lying down. They managed to call an ambulance, which came from the funeral home almost next door to the agency there. And ambulance took us over to the Burwell Infirmary, a black medical facility there in town.
You should probably point out that this is coming from an African American funeral home. You've gone to an insurance company run by African Americans. In other words, you don't have access to the white medical infrastructure at this point.
No. I'm sure that Dr. Dinkins could have called over to the Selma Hospital to get help, but he determined. My understanding is he determined that the injuries to Jim were so severe that the local hospital simply were not equipped to handle it. He called to the University Hospital in Birmingham and got permission to bring Jim to Birmingham. So we got into the ambulance in the Burwell Infirmary while we were there. I held Jim's hand, and he squeezed mine tighter and tighter and tighter as the pain increased in his head. It was internal bleeding. And then finally his hand relaxed, apparently, and then he lapsed into unconsciousness. So I was the last person in contact with Jim as a conscious living human being. He didn't die at that moment. He just lapsed into unconsciousness.
Were they able to, forgive me for interrupting this, but were they able to do anything for him at that infirmary? I don't know how well equipped they were.
I don't remember their doing anything for him. Again, there was no blood. Right. It was just a realization. In retrospect, at least, I assume that the doctor knew that there was a lot of internal bleeding going on from the fracture. From the blow to his head.
So you got into that ambulance and on the way to Birmingham, right?
Yes. Then before we did, we called over to the Brown Amy Chapel and left a message with a Unitarian colleague that we were that what had happened to us and that we were on the way to Birmingham. That message was passed to Martin Luther King, Dr. King, as he was speaking, and Dr. King announced publicly that three Unitarian ministers had been hit, and they were on their way to Birmingham, and one of them possibly suffered a concussion. That, I assumed, was the first public statement of that anything had happened, the first public knowledge. I did talk with someone just the other day who was in the audience that night, and he said that there were rumors about something having happened, but that was all. He didn't know any details. They didn't know any details until King announced it. We got into an ambulance, back into the ambulance then, and started driving toward Birmingham. It was about a mile out of town when suddenly we had a flat tire. And we faced the question. We were on this, what I remember is a two-lane road, and I don't remember any other cars going by us in that. It was now by night. It was then nighttime. And what to do? Change the tire, not change the tire. We decided we needed to get a call for a second ambulance to come. But it turned out the radio telephone in the ambulance did not work. So that was a surprise and a scary thing, because then it began to leave the question with us, is this a conspiracy? We've been hit. We have a flat tire. The radio telephone doesn't work. And just about that time, a car full of white men pulled up behind us on this country road and simply parked in the car behind us. And we decided we absolutely could not just wait. We had to turn around. We had to turn around and drive on the rim of the wheel back to the edge of town. The driver of our car, a young black man, had worked in a radio station there at the edge of town, and he thought that he could make a phone call from there. So that's what we did. And the car full of whites behind us also turned around, came to the parking lot, parked right beside us. While the driver went in to make the phone call, the four men from the car got out and walked around our ambulance and knocked on the windows and said threatening words to us. They were definitely hostile. We had no idea what was going to happen to us. And then finally, the second ambulance came, and as it was arriving, it dawned on me that Orloff and I were going to have to get out of the ambulance and be in the outdoors with these four men who were walking around the car. We'd felt reasonably safe in the ambulance until that point. But we'd have to get out and shift Jim's body, still alive but unconscious, into the second ambulance. And we got out, and it was very scary for me. And one of the men came up to me and said in a very hostile tone of voice, "Hey, what's happening here?" And all I could bring myself to say was "Please don't. Please don't." That's all I could say. And in fact, they didn't do anything. A state police car came by, and we asked for an escort to Birmingham. And he said, "I will escort you out of town and get you on the right road, but you won't need me to go all the way to Birmingham." And I wondered when I heard that. It was the state police, after all, along with the sheriff's deputies who had attacked the marchers on Sunday, on Bloody Sunday. And I thought, is he going to lead us to the Klan, or is he really going to lead us toward the hospital? Big questions. And were those four men going to follow us in their car? I had no idea. It was a fearful situation. Well, we finally got on the way, and in fact, nothing else happened on the road. We did get led to the right place, to the right highway, and some hour and a half or so later, we arrived at the hospital in Birmingham, somewhere around 11 o'clock at night. And in Birmingham, they were ready for us. They had been called, of course, by Dr. Dinkins, and they were ready for us, and immediately Jim was brought into the emergency facilities to be taken care of. And Orloff and I then were faced with quite a number of media people, television reporters and so on, and the FBI agents. So we were up until about 1 o'clock in the morning answering questions with the FBI and with the media people about what had happened. But Jim was still unconscious at that time, and we had no idea whether he would live or not live. We had no idea the extent of the injuries.
We're talking to the Reverend Clark Olson today on the state of things. So it's about 1 in the morning. You've talked to the police. Again, you're waiting to hear word. When did you get word?
The hospital offered us a hospitality, that is a bed to sleep in overnight. A couple from the Unitarian Church in Birmingham had been very active in civil rights, and they'd heard on the news that what had happened. So they arrived at the hospital and offered us hospitality in their own home. So we went to their home. And the next day, they brought us back to the hospital and early in the morning. And it was interesting to see that there were yellow roses there that had been sent by President and Mrs. Johnson. And also soon in the morning, Marie Reeb, Jim Reeb's wife, and Jim Reeb's father were both there. They had arrived overnight. And we Orloff and I spent the day with more press people being interviewed by people for Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley and ABC News and so on. We also, Martin Luther King sent, I believe it was C.T. Vivian and Joseph Lowery, as part of his SCLC leadership team. They came and personally gave greetings and condolences to us and spoke to us on behalf of Dr. Martin Luther King. We went back to that same home overnight, and it was during the night, Thursday morning, 37 hours after the attack on us, that Jim Reeb died. What had happened was that the doctors had told Mrs. Reeb and the father that Jim, if he survived, would be nothing but a vegetable. That is, there was so much brain damage from the bleeding that he just would not be a normal human being, anything approaching that. And so they requested, as I understand it, that the hospital not add any more things to keep Jim's body alive, but rather just simply let him pass away. So that's what happened. And so Thursday morning, Jim had died, and the word was out. Meanwhile, public demonstrations across the country were numerous. Boston, Washington, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, etc. There were thousands of people who gathered in public places in front of the White House or in Boston Garden or Boston Common, to keep vigil when Jim was still alive on Wednesday, and then on Thursday to mourn the passing of Jim, the death of Jim from this brutal attack. And the news was all across the country. Newspapers carried headlines about it.
Reverend Olson, I'm going to take a break right here, and then we're going to come back and talk to you some more about this. My guest this hour is Reverend Clark Olson, Unitarian minister and civil rights activist. We'll hear what happened next and the response both from the White House and from Reverend Olson as our conversation continues on the state of things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Reverend Clark Olson from Asheville, a public speaker, Unitarian minister, and civil rights activist who was in Selma, Alabama, 50 years ago for that historic march and its aftermath. You were telling us about the death then of James Reeb, the Reverend James Reeb. You learned about it And it was already nationwide news. The president knew about it. Dr. King had already spoken about it. But I'm wondering what's going on with you? You were very busy, clearly. The press was talking with you, the FBI. You had lots of interviews. And it becomes this national news story. And then there's this moment when you confront this violent death, and you were so close. And I wonder, in your mind, what happened when you got the news, again, amidst all of this sort of national, international turmoil, and then this very personal story for you?
Well, the first thing was, I guess I'd say the first thing that happened was that it was news now that 3-4 men had been arrested for these. And I was pleased that so soon after, 2 days or whatever, after the attack on us, these four men had been arrested in Selma, and so I was pleased that justice might take its course, proper course in this case. And immediately, I was thinking that there might be probably would be a murder trial, and one of the thoughts I had was that I, having been the one of us who turned and saw the club swung, I thought to myself, I may have to be maybe the sole witness to the actual attack on us. And that was a thought very much on my mind because the question came up, do I stay and go to the memorial service, which by just about then had been scheduled for the coming Monday afternoon in Selma. And I decided I did not want to stay in Selma. I did not want to go back to Selma. I'm sure part of it was just, as it were, youthful desire to get back home to Berkeley, but also this sort of realistic, rational point that I might be attacked. If I went back to Selma, I might be attacked. It could be that someone else saw all this happen and saw that I was one and might know in some way that I might testify against whoever it was who attacked us. So I felt uneasy about going back for fear for myself. The other thing that I was aware of was how much this attack had attracted the president's attention and how he was now using it. I was aware that President Johnson wanted to have a Voting Rights Act passed, but that politically he felt he couldn't garner the support for it. There wasn't enough public support. But this attack on the white minister had brought to Johnson's attention the possibility that now was the time to get this much-desired voting rights bill passed.
Well, let's talk about that. Let me just talk about that for a second, because the president did respond quickly. A consummate politician, Lyndon Johnson, understood that now was his moment to act because, in fact, a white man had been killed. Isn't that precisely how he turned this? And frankly, it was successful.
Yes, it was part of, you know, it's an indication of the racism in our society that Jimmie Lee Jackson, who was killed the month before in Marion, Alabama, right near Selma, Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed in a voting rights demonstration in the center of his town, but that received virtually no attention from the press. The Selma to Montgomery march was set up as a memorial to Jimmie Lee Jackson. That was the idea. But that was scarcely known by people. The attack on Jim Reeb was the thing that brought the public attention. There is some specific evidence from this that I have heard. That is, a producer for the History Channel, I think it was, came to my home and interviewed me some years ago now, 10 years ago perhaps. He said he had done some research in the Johnson Library in Texas and learned that in reference to Jimmie Lee Jackson, President Johnson had not one phone call, But in reference to the attack and then the death of James Reeb, President Johnson had 57 phone calls. So that numeric discrepancy between the two is startling evidence of, in effect, of the racism that the attack on a white man, the killing of a white man, a white clergyman, I'm sure that added to it, brought Johnson's attention to the possibilities here. He offered the presidential plane to bring James Reeb's then widow and father back to Wyoming. He was in it, right. The yellow roses and the airplane and so on.
Right.
And then the following Monday, Johnson called Congress and spoke to the nation. There was one particular thing that stood out for me, besides his ending his speech with, "And we shall overcome," which was itself very significant historically. He said, "At times history and fate meet at a single time in a single place to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom." So it was at Lexington and Concord. And when I heard that, I just was astonished because I was born in Boston and Lexington and Concord was part of my DNA, as it were. And then he said, "So it was a century ago at Appomattox, and so it was last week in Selma, Alabama. There, long-suffering men and women peacefully protested the denial of their rights as Americans. Many were brutally assaulted. One good man, a man of God, was killed." Thus, Johnson singled out the death of James Reeb in that moving call for the Voting Rights Act, and which would, in fact, prove to be a turning point in American and world history. That has been such an important piece of my self, as it were, my sense of being, my sense of purpose, my sense of a gift to me, mm-hmm. as it were, that I was a part of that and part of that turning point. I did go back to Selma. I did go back. Orloff and I both went back for the grand jury hearing first. And we were met at the airport in the nearest airport to Selma in Montgomery. We were met by Sheriff Clark's deputies who were there to escort us to Birmingham, to Selma. Hmm. And that was a question in our minds.
Did you wonder, at the moment, which way
yes.
you were going? Yeah, I can imagine.
Yes, we wondered what was going to happen. Yeah. It was a little scary after the Sheriff Clark's deputies, of course, were those who attacked the people on the Edmund Pettus Bridge on Bloody Sunday. Mm-hmm. We went back. We testified to the grand jury. And then some months later, the jury trial itself. And I had to I was asked, do I recognize in the room anybody who was among the attackers? And I looked and saw the one person that I believed was the one who had swung the club and pointed at him. I did it with some, I have to say, some hesitancy, some sense of awful responsibility, because I said to myself, well, maybe I'm pointing at the wrong person, and maybe if this trial goes through as I hope it would, that somebody is going to go in jail for the rest of their life for the murder of Jim Reeb. It was just a sense of awesome responsibility. The trial was before an all-white, all-male jury. Of course, the juries were made up of names taken from the list of registered voters. Who's registered to vote in the South? There are in many places in the South. It's almost entirely white people. And so naturally the jury was made up of white people. The defense said that it was the voting rights activists who deliberately killed Jim Reeb in order to create a martyr. I have understood from people who have recently been in Selma and talked with a variety of citizens in Selma, and that was a myth that was believed in still 50 years later by some of the people or many of the people in Selma, that it was Jim was killed deliberately to make a martyr.
Well, apparently the jury believed it as well.
Yes.
The men were, they were acquitted.
They were acquitted, yes. They were acquitted. Unanimous decision. They were not guilty.
I wonder what you make of it now. I mean, just that tension. You have this gross miscarriage of justice in the trial, and yet there's this tragic event that leads to essentially is the motive force behind the Voting Rights Act. So there's this monumental legislation that's passed as a result, a progressive step, and yet when racism is institutionalized, you can have progressive legislation and then this drag on social progress. What was going through your mind in that moment?
Well, first, I was thrilled that the Voting Rights Bill was passed. I did and do still feel that it was a tipping point in American history, indeed world history. And the number of blacks holding positions, elected positions across the country has shot up very, very significantly over the last 50 years. But of course, we know now that there is still a good deal of prejudice out there, a good deal of racism out there. It's evident in more current events in our society. And we know it in the efforts by some southern legislatures particularly to put up again some of the barriers to registering to vote, cutting the number of days available to register, cutting out the idea of registering and voting the same day, requiring photo IDs from people who don't necessarily have a photo ID handy and it would be expensive for them to have the transportation or pay the fee or whatever to get a photo ID. I think that there is still another turning point that's emerging in our society. I believe that there is enough community activity now that is the genesis of a new turn and a new tipping point. It's not going to be the last one needed, and the one we experienced 50 years ago was not the last one needed either. It's a continuous, I won't say battle, it's a continuous process of development of democracy. And it's not inevitable. It requires people to do something. But I do think overall there is some progress. And I'd like to read something which is kind of special to me. It was written by... It was a recent Facebook post by a granddaughter of James Reeb. She wrote, this was just in the last few weeks. She wrote, "In the last week, my grandma," that is James Reeb's widow, "my grandma has been going through all the boxes she has saved from when my grandpa was murdered. She showed me one that was sent shortly after his murder, one which made me cringe and laugh in shock at the same time. It reads something along the lines of, 'Keep the white race pure. We can't have any of these white and Negro couples or children that are born yellow-skinned from being a mix of white and Puerto Rican, Cuban, or other such people. I hope,' he said, 'one of your daughters marries someone from another race. Then you have to have mixed grandchildren sitting in your front room. Then you'll know how it feels.'" And Leah Reeb goes on to say, "Well, Mr. Ignorant, we did exactly what you recommended against. 3 years ago today, surrounded by our family and close friends, barefoot on the sand in Costa Rica, I exchanged vows with my Costa Rican. I love his beautiful tan skin, and I love his family and where he comes from, his black grandfather included. And my pure white grandmother," in your words, pure white, "my pure white grandmother who wrote you this letter loves my Costa Rican husband, who I one day plan to have yellow-skinned babies with. Bless you, sir, who wrote this lovely letter to my family without a return address. If you would have left one, my grandma would have sent you a nice letter back like she did with all the other supportive letters and hate mail she received." I hope the world has shaped you into a loving, tolerant man if you're still alive, because you should have been writing a letter with your condolences so many years ago, rather than one which a granddaughter laughs at. I love that Facebook entry. It's that's, to my mind, a wonderful expression of the fact that there is greater tolerance of interracial marriage. There's a greater tolerance of LGBT people in our society. There's simply a greater tolerance building, partly from the changing demographics and partly from an increase, in some cases, a massive increase in tolerance, particularly around this gay sexual issue, the massive shift in opinion in America. And I think that same kind of shift can now occur regarding racial issues.
Reverend Olson, it was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'm glad to have been asked. Thank you.
Reverend Clark Olson is a civil rights activist, a Unitarian minister, and he joined us from WCQS in Asheville. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is the technical director. Jess Clark, our intern. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.